and I will push people. I call it my superpower. Like, I can get anyone to run 5K. I can get, if you rock up for the first 2 weeks, I will get you to the finish. And, you know, it requires, sometimes I go, I went and got a young lad from his house the other day because he went, there was something that happened and he was feeling down. And so I just went and knocked on his door and I said, come on. And he just put his shoes on and came out.
Story for you.
I'm Matt Levinson. My guest today has competed in the New York, Chicago, Gold Coast and North Coast marathons. Georgia Weir wasn't always a runner. In fact, she came to the sport relatively late, but she's founded a truly life-changing community running program called Deadly Runners, run by and for First Nations people. When I heard about it, I wanted to know more, and not just because I'm training for my first ever marathon right now, but also because the more I dug in, the more I wanted to know about this, the project itself and how Georgia came to set it up. That's what this podcast is really all about. It's about talking to people who start things, make great things happen, and just kind of getting below that surface and understanding how they came to be the person who made that thing happen. Georgia, thank you so much for agreeing to do this.
Thanks, Matt.
We're sitting here in a terrace in Glebe, a really gorgeous one, where you're staying while you're in town. You're based down in Narooma on the south coast generally. Is it right that you grew up in Queanbeyan? That's where you came up?
Not really. Okay. I grew up most of my formative years in Canberra, which is just over the border, but moved to Queanbeyan when I was around 21.
Yeah, in my mind, those places are so overlapping, but when you're there, they're so different, aren't they?
Yes. Yeah, you ask anyone from Queanbeyan, we're not part of Canberra.
What was your childhood like?
It was good. We moved a bit. I was actually born in Sydney and lived here till I was about five. Then Dad's work took us to Darwin. So that's where most of my dad's family are, up that way. And then when I was about 10, we moved to Canberra.
Where were you in Sydney when you were born?
So my mum's family's from the Shire. So mum was born and raised in the Southern Shire around Cronulla and Miranda, and so that's where I lived.
Do you have any memories of that time down in the Shire, down in Miranda, or, you know, like as you moved up to the NT?
Yeah, I do. I definitely do have memories. I actually have really early memories. I remember my first birthday, which is quite rare, but yeah, I have fond memories of our time in Sydney, yeah.
Tell me about them.
Well, mum's family was all from there, so it's those memories, like those Christmases where you're playing cricket and going swimming with my pa and aunties and uncles, and yeah, really strong family memories of that time.
Was there I don't know what your family was like. Was it all First Nations people? What was your connection to that kind of community like?
So mum is of Irish ancestry, yep, and my dad is Aboriginal and African American.
Okay.
So yeah.
And did you feel that connection to the Aboriginal community in Sydney or in the NT when you were travelling through those, living in those parts of the country?
Not so much in Sydney.
Yeah.
Because it was all mum's family here. But in Darwin, yeah, that was, so about four or five was the real intro into, yeah, that side of the family.
What was it like, coming from, because the Shire is not, the Shire is pretty white bread, pretty, really kind of pretty insular part of our city. What was it like going to the NT and having that experience then?
Yeah, the Shire is very much exactly how you described. Look, I have two older brothers, so we were always darker. Do you know what I mean? And being around family, we always had darker skin and darker hair. So going up there was probably, like, thinking back, it was probably having like a an understanding of like, okay. Like, so I used to meeting family and aunties and cousins, and you're like, you kind of, I guess, feel, you didn't even know there was a little bit missing or a little bit of a question, but it all kind of made sense, I guess, yeah.
Yeah, when did you leave the NT? Where?
89, 90.
Right.
So when I was about 9, yeah.
And you land, so you leave this place where you felt a bit of a connection with aunties, with yep. kind of the extended family, and you move again to Canberra. Yep. What was that like for you as a 9, 10-year-old landing? Because that's when you start as a kid to make a whole bunch of important connections, and you're starting to come into your own space as a, not as an adult yet, but like as someone who's got their own identity, right?
Yeah, definitely. Look, the Canberra community, the mob there, that's very much home for me. That's what I consider my community, and that's where I feel I belong. But yeah, it's a huge culture shock going from NT down to Canberra. So, and we had no family connection down there too. You know, a lot of mob, especially around New South Wales, like even my husband, he's a black fella too. So there's always cousins and family, and I didn't have that. So it wasn't until, you know, I guess I realised when I went back to Darwin in my 20s that I was sitting at a table with all these mob that I was all related to. And I said to my husband, this is really rare for me to be able to do this, which he kind of took for granted being from, you know, New South Wales, that, you know, when you see mob out, there's a good chance, you know, you're related to them in your hometown. So, it was, I guess, and even more so now realising how important community is. Like, I didn't have my blood family around, but there's definitely a lot of mob in Canberra, Queanbeyan that, like I said, that's home and that's my community.
Yeah, I reckon sometimes having had the lack of it means that you appreciate it a bit more, right? Like, you know, people who grew up in that, like your partner, you know, it's just normal, right? Whereas you had come up, you'd felt the lack of it, you'd felt the discovery of it in a way. I mean, I can't help but think that some of the stuff that you've done since then, building community with Deadly Runners, we're going to talk about that in a while, stems from some of that kind of feeling of appreciation of community.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, we're wired for community as humans, you know, and belonging. So that's actually really interesting, Matt. I never thought of it that way, but yeah, what an insight.
Your mum had she worked in government, she works in grant making and that kind of thing now, right? And was that what took you to Canberra?
It was actually Dad's work. So Dad grew up in Cairns and in Darwin. And he did pretty well for, you know, a black fella of his time. He achieved a lot. He was part of the very first Indigenous All-Stars team that went over to New Zealand in 1973 and just got into government jobs early on. So it's actually Dad's work that took us from Sydney to Darwin, then Darwin to Canberra.
So that sports achievement was something that was kind of in your story well before you got to the point where you're at now.
Yes, yeah.
Did you, so you were talking at the start about like playing cricket, swimming, all that. Was your family a sporty family? Was that?
Very much so, yeah. Like I said, I had two older brothers, Nathan and Sean, and sport was a big part of life. We all played a lot of sport, basketball, netball, swimming. I remember getting up in those Canberra winters at stupid o'clock to go swimming. So yeah, it was a huge part of our life growing up.
I spent a bit of time in Canberra for a bit, and I loved going down swimming at the Cotter and, you know, other parts around the city where you could kind of have that free access. And it was, you know, a really different side of Canberra to the one that I think a lot of people think about when they think about the place.
Yes, yeah, that's really, really good. I actually don't know a lot of people that know about the Cotter who don't live there, but yeah, it's a good swimming spot.
What was school like for you at that time?
School was okay. I struggled a lot academically. I actually grew up thinking I wasn't very smart, which, you know, I still, being in the spaces that I'm in now, I feel like it's still something, like those early traumas that still haunt you a little bit. So I struggled. I never actually finished year 10 even, so because I left, because it was just an uncomfortable place for me, school was, yeah.
You went straight into a job in government around that time, right?
I did. So around 16, I got my first job at the Canberra Institute of Technology, so like the TAFE equivalent, in the Urana Centre, which was a support centre for the Indigenous students. So I was there a few days a week. So that was my start.
What was it like?
It was cool. It was good. I was working. I was with mob. Yeah, it was a good intro. I'm still I look back and I, you know, worked in government at state and federal level off and on for about 15 years. And it really, I'm really grateful for what I learned from that. It wasn't for me, but I learned a lot. Like I don't like writing, but and I don't find it easy, but I can. And there's all these little skills that I look back that I gain from people and supervisors that just invested time in me as a young person. And, yeah, I'm very grateful for that time I had in government.
Tell me what you learned.
I think just the basic skills of, you know, that a lot of people can struggle with, just about even expectations of, like, you know, the APS code of conduct, you're asking, it's such an eye roll. But, you know, there's a lot of things, it gives you a lot of structure and discipline on what's expected. So the Deadly Runners workplace, you know, is a very relaxed one. But it also, you know, it sets a standard, I guess, on what should be expected. So, yeah.
That can be something that's a real challenge for small not-for-profits, establishing themselves and having norms of behaviour in the workplace and a lot of that sort of stuff. And I guess is that the kind of stuff that you took away from it, like being able to, you know, how you operate in a workplace, how you kind of set up proper processes and that kind of thing? Is that what you're talking about?
Yeah, definitely. But it also gave me insight onto what isn't necessary. And it's also mob work differently as well. We don't necessarily do, I won't say do well, but that real structured workplacing doesn't always work for us as well. We've got other obligations that, you know, family's always number one and most important. So, yeah, it's been.
So in a way, like, you learnt the system that government has, but were able to evolve that
very
for
much
the needs of your community. Is that
Yeah, very much so, yeah.
What was life in like? I mean, this is like a period of 15 years. It's kind of like, you know, when I was looking back over your kind of life to date, it's almost like there are three sections. There's the first section before you left school. There's the second, third, that is this period of working in government. And then there's the third up to now, which is running and Deadly Runners, which we're going to talk about. In that third, you know, that middle third, you also had four kids, right? I mean, you've got five kids now. You had four kids in that period when you're working in government. That's a massive transition in anyone's life.
Yeah, and I had two of those by the time I was 20 as well. So, but I mean, it's also during that time I was battling addiction as well. So always functioned, but there was always that that battle that was there. But yeah, kid, I think looking back, it was probably being a mum that it would have been a lot worse had I not had my kids, I think, but and my husband.
It's a massive load. I mean, that period, it's like it's kind of a unique place that you were at, maintaining work, continuing to deliver in that way, having four kids, managing the stresses. I can't imagine having done all that in my 20s. I know in some ways that led you to the moment where you started running, but how can you talk me through that experience? I don't want you to dredge up stuff that's tough to dredge up, but I'd love to kind of get a sense of how you got to that point where running was the thing you had to do.
Yeah, sure. So I think I don't, like you just said, how did you manage it? And I don't think I really did very well, but it was tough. You know, like I said, I worked and I functioned and we bought a house and we had kids, but there was always the drinking, and then the drinking, there was always the drug use, and then the effects of that, you know, you're fighting with your partner because you're hungover, or you're not doing things with your kids because you're too unwell on the weekend. So I think what a real blessing was I had my husband in a really, I don't know if it was gentle, but I always expected better of myself, and he always did too. It was never like you can do better type of thing, but it was like, come on, Georgia, like, what are you doing? And I think what saved me is I always had this belief that something was off. It was never, I did feel like I was a bit of a, you know, stuff up, but there was always curiosity there about where I could potentially go and be if I wasn't drinking or if I didn't have this addiction. And I don't even think I identified it as addiction at the time, really. But, yeah, and it was finally getting a diagnosis in 2010, an incorrect diagnosis, mind you, of bipolar. But that was probably a real turning point because I was put on medication and I thought I'd found all the answers. Like, oh, I've just – and then I kind of became my identity a bit and was used as an excuse for poor behaviour looking back. But these medication that you put on, it's strong stuff, really strong stuff. And I remember one time I was going to I took my medication in the morning and about 40 minutes later I went to put a load of washing on. And as I was putting the clothes in the machine, the meds kicked in and I couldn't even finish putting the clothes in the machine and I went and laid down, was just a zombie. So that's ultimate. I think it was the medication that was being prescribed was increasing, like the amount. And that's when I started thinking there has to be something else. There has to be another way for me to manage this.
I know that feeling when you're like at, you know, your mental health is bottoming out and you want to be yourself as well in that moment. You don't want to be over medicated. You want to like find your way through. What was it that got you to lace on some trainers?
I got my box of medication down one morning and there was about 10 different types in there and I just had this moment where I was like, I just made a decision. I'm not doing this. I'm not waking up. I'm like, am I going to wake up at like 60 and 70 and still be taking all of, like, it just was a bit unfathomable for me. And my partner had left, like Michael had left once before with all the kids because things were out of hand with me. So it was, that's where it came about. I'm like, I'm going to have to look at other alternatives. So I just, like, I was a really sporty kid, but that didn't carry on into my 20s. And then at like 29, I took up running as a last resort. As like, I'll give this a go and see what happens.
What was the first run? Do you remember it?
I do. I'd planned to do a run and we were coming up Cooma Road in Queanbeyan and I got my husband to drop me off a couple of K before home. So I had to run. And yeah, that was my first run. I do remember it.
How did it go?
I remember it was time. I was using an app and when I got to my house, I still had probably about 5 or 6 minutes to go. And I had this moment where I would normally go, I've done 10. I'll just go home. Like, even though it's 5 minutes to go, I've done a good slog, so I'll just go home. And I had this moment where I'm like, no, that's been your best thinking so far and it hasn't worked out too well for you. So I remember doing the extra, it wasn't the extra, but I remember completing the session properly. And that was a real switch for me because I was someone who didn't usually finish stuff. And I'm like, no, and it was coming from a place of having enough of how I was living. I'm like, no, you've got to finish it.
How did it go from there? What was next?
Good. I committed to running 3 days a week. The biggest thing was a huge reduction in my anxiety. That was like, I thought I'd discovered something magical. I was like, this is amazing. So yeah, that was the first thing I noticed.
Did you have a run, like a race that you were targeting at that point?
Or yeah, I did. Yeah. I think within like the first week of starting to run, I signed up for a 5K in Sydney and I'm like, I'm just going to do it. So yeah, that's what I did. Did my first 5K.
And how did that go?
Yeah, good. It was good. I remember pushing myself and, you know, now that I've dug into this a lot more and looked into why it had such an impact on me and why Deadly Runners has such an impact too. But it was just that reward of committing to something, being disciplined, focusing, sitting with discomfort, and then knowing that at the other side of this discomfort was a feeling of accomplishment.
At this point, you'd been smoking since you were 14. You'd been drinking a lot, as you said. How quickly did you give away the smoking, reduce the drinking? I know that stuff happened with time, but like, how quickly did that happen for you as you started running?
Yeah, so I had my fourth baby at 29 and quit smoking when I was pregnant. When she was, probably 4 to 6 weeks old, I went out and had a huge night and smoked like a packet of cigarettes after not smoking for about, you know, 10 months. I just thought, I've got to stop. Oh, that was like, I've got to stop. Like, I'm nearly 30. If I don't, like, when do you stop if you don't do it now? So because I'd already put a good solid, you know, 10 months in and kind of had that night of a reminder of what it felt like to be a smoker. So I'd stopped smoking, and then the drinking slowly decreased as I was running more because the anxiety was decreasing. So therefore the drinking was too.
What you're saying is you were turning to alcohol as a kind of self-medication. You're kind of dealing with it to calm yourself, right?
Definitely.
Yeah, yeah.
Yep.
Which so many people do, right?
Yeah.
So in 2013, this is just over a decade ago, you were selected to run the New York Marathon with the Indigenous Marathon Foundation. I mean, you ran it, which is such a huge accomplishment. I'm gearing up for my first marathon, and you know, it's in 3 weeks' time, and
Oh, wow.
I'm in the final stages. I think for a lot of people to hear that alongside all you've accomplished since, you know, they'd think it came easy. You know, you strapped on the runners very quickly, you did your first 5K, then you ran in the New York Marathon, you know. What was it actually like for you? You know, was it a really kind of natural path from that first run, you know, out of Cooma to New York?
Yeah, so I think when I was selected for the project, because I had an expectation like this is what you're going to do, so I had a bit of pressure of not wanting to let anyone down too. So I think that helped a lot. But I was kind of hooked as well. So even though the drinking had drastically reduced, it would still pop up. I'd still occasionally drink, but much less frequently. But yeah, I think having an expectation put on me definitely helped get me to the first marathon.
Well, talk me through the training schedule, because you know, anyone who's done a marathon knows that, like, well, speaking for myself, you know, I'm coming up to my first one, and I don't think I've ever worked as hard for anything in my life as I've worked for this, you know, like training multiple, you know, four times a week, strength training, you know, like getting up early all the yep. time, you know, like running so far that you just, your legs just feel like they're absolutely at their, yep. the end of their capacity. Talk me through that experience for you. And I mean, I guess like it sounds like you had a real sense of determination and also a sense of accountability to yourself and to others to do it. But were there times along the way where it felt like it was just, I know I've had those times where I'm out running, I'm just like, I just don't even know if I can do this.
Yes, yeah, definitely. And I think the process of training for a marathon I'm just trying to get the right words here. Like I said earlier, I'd never finished anything or really committed much. And because I was at a point where I'd had enough, I was really ready for change and really ready for the commitment that it took. So, and I responded really well to the discipline and the structure of training, and like really well. So I was very, and I remember part of my motivation was being able to prove to myself that I could change and that I didn't need medication. So there was a few reasons why I was super committed and nothing was going to get in my way, so to speak. But I think I enjoyed that. You know that saying that hurts so good? I think that's why I kind of enjoyed the hurt, because it, you know, it meant that I was working hard and that I was working towards something. There was going to be a cool reward at the end. So, yeah.
I love the sense that you, in those moments, you experience a sense of accomplishment in one part of your life that feels transferable to other parts of your life. You feel like you can do this thing that you didn't even know if was in the range of things that were available to you to do. And that kind of gives you a bit of a boost in the other parts of your life, that it's almost like, I can do this big thing, I can do another big thing. Did you feel that as well?
Yeah, definitely, Matt. That's that was really a big part of what running has done for me, is that discipline, the focus, the commitment, that transferred over into other areas 100%, because you think, like you said, I can't do it, it's too hard. Oh, hang on, I can do it. So, and like I touched on earlier, it's that what long distance running teaches you to sit with is discomfort. And typically people with a lot of, you know, people with addiction issues can't sit with discomfort very well. So I think that's what long distance running, you know, one of the big things it's taught me is to be able to sit with discomfort.
you were just about to go off to New York to run your first marathon, which is outrageous. First thing, you know, not starting in Sydney or Canberra or something. But you were about to go to New York. The Boston Marathon happened. The bombings at the Boston Marathon happened. It must have, you must have had just an outrageous mix of nerves going into that first thing and then to have that happen. What was it like getting on that plane?
Yeah, I remember, I think I did an interview leading up, or I did do an interview leading up, and I remember one of the questions was just, you know, are you nervous? There's just been a bombing at in Boston, and I was determined not to let it affect where I was going, like my goals. So there was, of course, that natural worry, but, you know, I guess I just pushed through, and it's also not wanting to let, you know, the bad guys win in a sense and get the better of you. So, yeah.
And how was it that final week?
I was tired. I was actually injured for about 2.5 months leading up to New York. So I did a lot of my training in a pool. So I ran deep water running and did all my like interval sessions and long run in the pool. So, and I was only actually on the road, I think, the 4 weeks before the marathon.
Whoa.
Yeah. Yep.
How was it? That must have amped up the nerves. Like, can I even, you know, like I'm running. I know, like, I've been out there running on the road, kind of a vaguely comparable situation. Were you just thinking, yeah, I've been doing it in the pool. Like, is it even going to work when I get out on the road?
Yeah, I knew. I mean, I was so determined. Like, yep. I said, it was like the first time in my life that I'd done something big. So I was so determined to do it. So even my coach at the time, I remember him going, George, I don't know if you're going to make New York. And I said, no, I am. I'll be doing it. So I was very determined. I think I probably would have crawled to finish it if I had to.
After you finished it, that huge accomplishment, I guess a lot of people would go on to maybe do more marathons or maybe an ultra or a triathlon or something, or maybe they'd find some other hobby. But instead of doing that, you went back to your community and started running training programs for other runners. Can you talk me through how that came about, how you sort of came up with the idea of starting training others?
Yeah, sure. So I think because running had such a profound impact on my mental health, I did get my cert for in fitness and became a qualified recreational running coach. So I offered it to the local mob in Queanbeyan because I wanted to remove those barriers to participation that mob might have, like who can afford, you know, a personal trainer, or so it was just offered for free, and it was that real basic 0 to 5K model. And yeah, it took off.
You had a day job in a homelessness specialist support service at the time. So you were getting up bright and early every morning and just doing this on top?
Yeah, in addition to training for a marathon too. So some mornings it was like a 4:30 a.m. start. I'd get my training in, then meet the deadly runners, train them, then go home, get ready for work and start. So it was a pretty hectic schedule, but I was so committed, and to passing on what I had experienced from running. That was what my motivation was. It was like I just wanted other people to experience a feeling, really, is what I had. So it was like I said, you know, I thought I'd found something magical. I could have show people this.
What was that feeling? How could you convey that to people? Because I guess some of these people, they couldn't even run for like a minute or whatever. You know, how do you convince them that there is this magic that's available to them?
It's always sold, I guess, as a look, just come and learn 5K, learn how to run 5K. And, you know, those initial groups in community are the ones that really not set the standard, but they're the change makers, because they're the ones that have taken the risk to take on this, this challenge. So what happens is their friends and family watch their journey on social media, and that then opens them up to the possibility of, oh, maybe I can do this too. So that's really important in how Deadly Runners grows as well. So, I never tell anyone what's going to happen. Like, this is amazing. It's just like, just come a few days a week and we'll get you running 5K nonstop.
I read a story, a news story about one of the women in that first group of runners, called Ashley, who said she wanted to move away to better her life, as she believed her community was stuck in a destructive cycle of drugs and alcohol. She was suffering post-traumatic stress stemming from her childhood, and you know, like, there was really, really challenging stuff that she was dealing with, depression. For her, she said exercise was a remedy to that. So much kind of aligning with what you've been talking about, Georgia. What was it like for you to see others starting to get that benefit that you'd experienced yourself?
Oh, I don't think I even have the words to describe it. It's what keeps me in the game, so to speak. It's what keeps me going. To watch that change is because, you know, at the start of a group, when someone starts their running journey, I know what's going to happen if they stick with it. So I can't even put words on it. It's brought me to tears. It brings them to tears. And that flows onto a whole community too. So, yeah, I'm even getting a bit emotional thinking about it. It's a pretty incredible feeling knowing that you've been, you know, a small part in changing someone's life to a degree, but also just equipping them with tools and knowledge to make changes themselves.
Yeah, it's such an awesome thing, isn't it?
Yeah.
And it must build such camaraderie within the groups that you're forming.
Yeah, definitely. There's that for a lot of – it's changing now, but, you know, back 10 years ago when Deadly Runners started, over 10 years ago now, there's a lot of mob. We weren't meeting up over something that was just pure positivity and goal setting and achieving together. So I think that's, you know, why Deadly Runners worked too. There was those positive social connections that were being formed and we were doing it together.
Was it called Deadly Runners right from the start?
Or? No, it was just – we didn't really have a name because it was just, oh, come down and learn how to run. And then Arnie Annette, who's our the Deadly Runners mother hen, we were going to come up with a name and she said, why don't we just call ourselves Deadly Runners? And that's where it started.
I love that. It's just such a perfect name for it.
It is so simple, yeah.
When did, you know, that first group started in Queanbeyan, started to take shape and started to build out? Was it from the start, was it something that you hoped to replicate in a larger way? Once you'd, you know, you'd nailed it down, you'd called it Deadly Runners, what did you ever see what it could become?
My intention was initially it was just to get people moving, and then it grew, it got a lot bigger, I got a lot of attention. There were other communities that contacted me to help get the knowledge around how to set one up. Yeah, definitely. Well, it was never an intention to create this huge movement, but that's exactly what happened.
You've trained a lot of runners now through that program and, you know, through the various groups that you oversee. What have you, you know, there'll be a lot of people listening to this who are in exactly that same boat. You know, they're wanting to, you know, start running. They're wanting to start doing something. What do you tell them to do to get started?
If they're ready, the fact they've come to the decision that they're ready to do something means the motivation's already there. But just keep it simple. That's like my best advice. If sometimes this can be really overwhelming, people who haven't exercised or ran, it can be really overwhelming, the thought of having to start. So just keep it simple. Sometimes, even myself, when I'm getting back into running, it'll just be, I'm just going to, you know, run a really short distance till I feel comfortable. So to people who are starting out, even if it means walking, you know, so just go for a walk to build that habit of getting up. And once that habit's there, then you start, you know, jogging a little bit and then walking. And so it's definitely just keeping it simple.
Getting those habits in place, right?
Absolutely. And a lot of, you know, mob that start, they get into the first few weeks and they'll, you know, what should I eat and what shoes should I wear? And I'm always like, just get up and come running. Don't, like, you know, we will get to that later. It's just form the habit first.
Yeah, it's nice to have nice shoes, but yeah, really, yeah, that's not going to change your game.
That's right. That's right. Small changes.
You know, within a couple of years, you were getting a lot of recognition for Deadly Runners. You know, you won the 2015 ACT Night Out Person of the Year in Canberra. You know, for someone who'd started this, feeling like they were at rock bottom, feeling like there was no other option really than running, within a couple of years to be at that point, did that feel big?
Oh, yeah. It was very surreal. I'd only ever set out just help people start running. So to be recognised in that way was really surreal. It was very bizarre, you know. All, I just wanted to help people to have a feeling. That's all it ever started out as. So, yeah, to start getting recognition like that was really, yeah, strange, I guess.
How did you handle it?
It was, I think I handled it, you know, I have my husband's very grounding for me, and so he was always a good person to speak with. But I think, yeah, I think it was, yeah, easy does it.
You ran New York with support from Rob DiCostello's Indigenous Marathon Foundation, as we were discussing a bit earlier, and they wound up sort of auspicing and backing some of the growth of Deadly Runners in those early days. Can you talk to me about how things worked as that process kicked off?
Yeah, so like I said, I started Deadly Runners and there was huge growth and interest, and well, then I realised that I needed to get some funding because it was consuming so much of my time and I was already working. So I started applying for grants with support from them, which was great, and they did auspice funds for a couple of grants, which was fantastic. It was, you know, it helped be able to deliver and strengthen what I was already doing. But, yeah, they did unfortunately start rolling Deadly Runners out as their own initiative as it was growing, because it was popular and it was creating this change Australia-wide. So, yeah, they started rolling it out as their own initiative. That broke me.
Do you remember when you first heard that was happening?
Yeah.
Or got an inkling that was happening?
It was very gradual, and it was very, because a lot of people were like, why didn't you say anything? And I remember I got an email from a staff member saying that they were going to send out this info pack to communities who wanted to start Deadly Runners. And I remember writing back going, oh, well, can we meet about this? Because this took me a lot of, this was hard work. Like this was a lot of trial and error, and we need to discuss this. And I ended up having a discussion with Rob in his bakery. And nothing ever came of it. I let him know what my issue was, and it was just very bizarre how it was handled. And I think now that I look back, I was, because my participation and selection in the program was life changing. You know what I mean? And it was a positive experience, and it gave me a platform. So I don't know if I felt indebted or I felt maybe ungrateful if I said something. And then they just started rolling it out. And, yeah, it led to me starting to drink more again. And then the drinking led to drugs. And then I was in a full-blown ice addiction for 2 years. So I left the family, left my kids, husband. So it was pretty awful. We lost our house that we'd saved to buy. And it was an awful, awful time.
You know, it's hard to rationalize how you get to that point as a charity. You know, Indigenous Marathon Foundation, they do great work.
Yep.
And so often with charities, they do such great work that it kind of creates a blind spot when they're not doing great work.
Absolutely.
And I think that's a real challenge for people running for purpose organizations, to constantly keep a critical eye on what they're doing and their decision making. It's such an easy thing to happen. I've seen it happen so many times. But for you, you know, you're in that point, this is around 2016 or so.
Yeah.
Again, you're a really tough place, and you know, being sort of disconnected from your family, losing things, losing the house. What happened to turn that around? Because that could easily go a long way further down, right?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, I wasn't at home with the kids. I think what saved me was I had my husband never gave up. So it was like we were broken people, and it was an awful time, and it was, you know, inflicted a lot of trauma on our kids, but he never gave up. So it towards the end when I got clean, I was definitely ready for it. So I remember towards the end, I always knew when I was in this addiction that it wasn't forever, but I was also in a tremendous amount of pain as well. So I got put into hospital. My husband got me put into hospital. And I was ready for it. You know what I mean? Like it was, and I mean like scheduled, like mental health. Like I had to go to hospital. It was, I managed to get assessed and so I had no choice. But I, like I said, I was very much ready for it. So I went into the mental health ward, detoxed, got out, and we literally packed what we owned into a four-wheel drive and drove north and landed in the Byron Shire.
I saw a video online from you talking to your supporters about it at that time, and it was extremely raw kind of video. What, you know, I guess in a way, just having the support of your partner in that, was that the thing that helped turn things around?
Definitely. I mean, he's a remarkable person. I think he's had this insight into understanding human behaviour from a very young age. So when I was, even though my addiction and my behaviour caused him so much pain, he's always said to me, I never forgot who you were or that you were the mother to our kids and you were a daughter and a sister. And he said, that's why I never stopped fighting for you, because you were still the kid's mum. He goes, even if we didn't end up together and, you know, there was too much damage done to our relationship, you still were the mother to our kids. And he never, our oldest girl is nearly 22, and she said to me in January that, you know, what minimised the damage to my relationship with the kids was the language that my husband used, and it was never mum's a junkie or she's on drugs or she left you. It was always mum's unwell and we need to get her better. So I think how he handled it honestly saved my life and my relationship with my kids.
Look, I can feel tears welling up hearing this story. I mean, if we all had someone like that, backing us, you know, we'd all be better for that. It Absolutely. Sounds amazing. So this is 2018. Going to 2019, you were selected for the Indigenous Business Accelerator. Is that timing right? You know, how did that come to happen? Because that feels like an incredibly fast turnaround.
It was incredibly fast. So I got clean in 2018. And that led to me needing to really look inward as well and do a lot of work on the inside, because I needed to understand how I got into that position with the drug. Like I knew I always had addiction, but how does someone who loves their kid, like I knew I loved my kids as much as any other mother, but how did I end up addicted to ice and not leaving my kids? So that led to a lot of inner work and understanding trauma, understanding how trauma affects your decision making, how to heal that trauma. And I wanted to, I also identified early on that I wanted to reclaim Deadly Runners, because I worked bloody hard for it and it needed to sit not with a non-Indigenous organisation but with a black person. So my husband had actually already done an IBA accelerator, and I applied and was accepted because I just wanted to develop the skills and knowledge on how to, not once I got it back, like once I got it back, but how to turn it into a business. You know, I think a lot of mob have a lot of shame around, we help a lot and we do a lot for communities for nothing. And I had done Deadly Runners for nothing for so long. So it was like, well, how do I keep this program free but make a business out of it? So that's what led to doing the accelerator. But yeah, it was very quick. It was within 6 months, I think.
Around this time, you also put in a trademark claim for Deadly Runners. Was that, you know, what's the timing there? Were they around the same time or?
Yeah, it was actually. So I had made contact with Rob and the Indigenous Marathon Foundation, and we tried to resolve it. You know, I flew to Canberra, me and my husband, and met with him, and I told him about, you know, this is what you did and this is how it affected me. And he was initially apologetic and wanted to acknowledge me in their fun run champs in Uluru, which he did, you know, acknowledge me as the creator of Deadly Runners. I thought, well, I'm going to trademark it. And in my head, I was like, I'll just license it to them. And that in itself, saying that I created this and I licensed it, to this organisation was like, that was enough. Do you know what
I mean? Takes a lot of nerve in a way when you're in that situation to do that.
Yeah. So I did trademark it, and I made a phone call to Robin, let him know, because I genuinely didn't think there would be a problem, because I'd just been acknowledged in Uluru by him as the person who created it. They acknowledged me in their 2016 annual report as the creator of this initiative. So I'm like, oh, well, I'll trademark it, and then had no intention of, you know, wanting them to stop using it. It was like, just let me be acknowledged as a person who did this. And he then went on to make several phone calls over the next few months asking me to sign the trademark over to him, which I didn't do. He then opposed the trademark. And then while that was happening, the Marathon Foundation did a post, I think it was on International Women's Day, about recognising their deadly running women. And up until this point, we kept really quiet about what was going on. But that kind of triggered my husband a bit, and he commented on their page and just said, this is a load of crap, and just spilt the beans and said, you've taken, you know, my wife's program, who's a graduate and a black person, you're a non-Indigenous organisation, you're challenging the trademark of the word deadly, and yeah, and you want to celebrate our black women.
Yeah, and you said he'd been through the IBA accelerator for his, it's like a fashion business, right? Clothing business.
Yeah, he had a t-shirt business.
Yeah, and he's also a rapper, right? Yeah. So, yep. You know, like, you know, you've got someone in the mix like that. Yep. They're going to step up and say something, aren't they?
Oh, absolutely, man. He's like, I've got to be careful sometimes, because he's my protector. So sometimes I've got to go, no, I need to handle this.
At this time, the Canberra Times stepped in with a big feature on the situation, right? And that feels like it was a really big catalyst for, you know, for you getting that trade, being able to move ahead with that trademark.
Yeah, that article, and in addition to that comment that my husband made on their page, the backlash was pretty, community weren't happy, and they were, and you know, you got to remember the Queanbeyan, I had a lot of supporters, and the Queanbeyan community watched this happen, and the Canberra community, they watched this happen to us. So people weren't happy, and then they, as a result of that, they pulled their opposition. So the Deadly Runners trademark sits with me, and, you know, I've said before, ideally it shouldn't sit with anyone, but I would rather it sit with a black person than a non-Indigenous organisation.
And that's where the rebirth of this Deadly Runners program really stepped back up. You ran a crowdfunding campaign to build, you know, the website, to build, you know, to get the T-shirts made and the singlets made and all that kind of stuff. Tell me, you know, like, this is now, as I was saying at the start, this is where we're at now, basically. We're at the end of that third of your life up to now. What have you learned? Like, you've been through some really tough times, and you've also had some really high highs.
Yep.
What have you learned about yourself and about resilience as well? Because I feel like that is a really kind of like, that's a central theme in where you're at now.
Yeah, I think, you know, that phase that I spoke about with the addiction and losing so much, it also gave me peace and clarity that I don't think I would have had otherwise, because it forced me to look inward. So I don't carry any of the heaviness that I used to. Of course, honestly, it was learning about trauma and my trauma that gave me freedom. But I think resilient people are people who have hope. So I think that's what I've realised. I've always had hope about and a positive outlook. If you're resilient, it means that, you know, you can get up and go again, and it's going to get better.
So yeah, it's not about falling over, is it? Because we all fall over sometimes.
Yeah. And, you know, sometimes sometimes at points in my life I haven't liked the word resilient, because I often get called that, but I think it's because it implies that you're always down and out. But I know I'm strong, I guess, but I just have always known, I've felt that I was always going to be part of something big, though I never knew what it was. And I've had that feeling ever since I was a teenager, I think.
Now we have Deadly Runners in Byron, in Batemans Bay, in Queanbeyan, in Naruma, yep. now where you're at. Where else? Are there others opening up?
So we only have like the face-to-face groups in Naruma, Wallaga Lake at the moment. So they're coached groups. So Deadly Runners has changed and evolved over the years. So we do have a lot of individual runners that run, and they're through, you know, Canberra, Queanbeyan, New South Wales, Southern Queensland, Northern Territory. So we have a WhatsApp group for the different locations and a national one. So we have runners that check in and, you know, put a selfie up after a run. And
there's a phone app now as well, isn't there?
There is an app. So that's something that, it was a lot of my time was people asking for running programs and how do I start running? So I put it all in an app so I can direct people to that now.
Tell me, you've had so many runners go through this program. Like, the success can't only be getting out and doing a 5K or a 10K. Obviously, that's the objective that they go in with, and that's what you get them training towards. But what other kind of metrics are you seeing in terms of the impact of the program that you're running?
Yeah, so I'm at a point now where I'm getting assistance to be able to measure this properly, because it's quite it's just remarkable. There's like the biometrics, you know, there's that you can measure, but there's something that happens on another level with the individual, their family, and the whole community. I think there's a lot of factors that play into why it's so impactful. I think one of them is the discipline and the focus it takes, that long distance running requires, and the sense of achievement. It's the sitting with discomfort that people, you know, sometimes aren't very good at. It's the positive social connections that are formed, and it's being coached through it by someone, because I know their journey when someone starts. So that's why I'm so invested, and I will push people. I call it my superpower. Like, I can get anyone to run 5K. If you rock up for the first 2 weeks, I will get you to the finish. And, you know, it requires, sometimes I went and got a young lad from his house the other day, because there was something that happened and he was feeling down. And so I just went and knocked on his door and I said, come on. And he just put his shoes on and came out. But I think it there's this effect that happens. And like I said, I'm in the process of getting help to actually measure this impact properly.
I love it. Tell me what the vision is for Deadly Runners.
Oh,
you know, if I came back and talked to you in 25 years' time, well, let's step it back. We've been talking in 15-year increments. What about 15 years' time?
Look, at this point, like I said, it's changed and evolved over time. So I would have said it was, you know, getting as many mob into running and as possible. But what I'm doing on the South Coast right now is I really want to refine and strengthen what I do there. A big part of Deadly Runners that we didn't mention is we do camps. So where people who have committed to the program go on a camp and they get their coaching qualification, they do their mental health first aid, and they do trauma training. That then enables people to have the qualifications to start a Deadly Runners in their own community and to coach it, or to, you know, they've got nationally accredited quals, so that might improve, you know, job participation as well. And the trauma training is really an eye-opener for a lot of mob, because there's so much trauma in our communities, and to really understand what it is shifts people. So I think being able to provide mob with those camps is where the change is going to happen. Like, I had one lady after our Uluru camp who said, oh, Deadly Runners isn't actually about running, is it? I go, no, it's not. She goes, I get it now. So I think being able to strengthen what I do and maybe replicate that, you know, in the communities that need it.
Georgia, it has been so great to have this conversation with you. Before I let you go, I want to ask you three quick questions.
Sure.
What's keeping you up at night right now?
Financial sustainability.
Yeah, that's a real challenge when you're running a program like this. Who else should I be speaking to?
Tom Dawkins. So he is the co-founder and CEO of Start Some Good. They provide like a suite of supports, I guess, for social enterprises. One of those supports is the crowdfunding platform Start Some Good, which I have used and my husband has used twice. And he's also the co-founder of Lend Some Good, which links social enterprises with impact investors. So he's a man with a wealth of knowledge in this space, really interesting. So he'd be really, really good to talk to.
Yeah, great suggestion. Last question, what gives you hope?
Deadly Runners gives me hope, seeing the change that happens.
Thank you so much for joining me today. What's the best place for people who want to find out more about Deadly Runners?
I would direct you to the website. We're kind of rebuilding that at the moment. Look, I think jumping on our social media, it just captures beautifully what we do.
This was produced and hosted by me, Matt Levinson. If you haven't heard the previous interviews in this series of podcasts, I really recommend you dig back in. I love the conversations with Sean Christie David, who started Played at Ford, the brilliant journalist Jess Hill, who has just changed the conversation about family violence, Mel Greblo, the founder of Scribd and Banksia Academy, who recommended I speak to Georgia today. There have been so many amazing conversations so far. I really recommend you dig back in. If you know someone who would be into listening to this, please recommend it. That's really the only way people find out about podcasts like this. Thank you so much for listening. And Georgia, thank you so much for being part of this.
Thanks, Matt.
I might have a story for you.